Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Bad and getting worse. That's what the man said. The man, I mean. The guy whose job it's going to be 2 weeks from now to fix the economy. The stimulus plan's not really in any doubt. What we're down to now is who gets what. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us today, everybody. It's Monday, the 5th of January. The Obamas officially arrived in Washington over the weekend. The girls started school today, and their dad got down to work. The president-elect made the rounds on Capitol Hill. He's trying to sell Congress on his $750 billion economic stimulus package. No guarantees, by the way, that that price tag's not going to go up some. But whatever the final number, the broad outlines, we've known for a while. The specifics, though, are starting to get interesting. Today we learned Mr. Obama wants to spend $300 billion worth of his recession-reversing stimulus on tax cuts. That'd be about 40% of the whole plan, and a change from what we thought was going to be a focus on infrastructure. We asked our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale to explain the switch.
The president-elect's economic advisors are looking at an income tax cut that would reduce paycheck withholding or provide tax credits for the working poor over a period of 2 years. The thinking is that's better than the one-time tax rebate that didn't work so well last year.
By and large, people take rebate money and save it or use to pay down debt, which is the same thing.
Bruce Bartlett is a former Treasury Department economist.
If you change taxes in such a way that people get an increase in their disposable income, not just one time, but week after week after week, they're much more inclined to increase their spending level because they view their permanent income as having increased.
But Michigan University professor Joel Slemrod isn't sure even that's enough to get consumers to open up their wallets.
If people are in trouble now, if their assets are depleted, it may be that a lot of tax cuts in the form of rebates are saved, no matter whether the Congress calls them temporary or calls them permanent.
And urban policy scholar Robert Puentes at the Brookings Institution thinks we can get money circulating even faster.
The one thing about infrastructure is that we know that the states will be spending it. Some additional federal help would certainly be something that they would not stick into a bank account.
But Republicans prefer tax cuts on the principle that it's better for people to decide how to spend their money. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
It's telling that the president-elect's first official piece of business in Washington was a visit with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. He's going to be hearing from a lot of members of Congress over the coming days as he pitches his economic program. And one of them may well take the opportunity to tell him about an odd tax phenomenon happening around the country. Even though home values are plummeting, property taxes in a lot of places are going up this year. And your bill may already be in the mail. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story.
It's a convergence of events years in the making. A massive housing boom followed by a major housing bust, a weak economy, and cash-strapped cities and towns that get as much as 70% of their revenues from property taxes and need that income to pay for services. So while property values drop, property taxes jump.
This happens in tax policy when you have volatility in the economy.
Bert Wisenin is a fiscal analyst with the National Conference of State Legislatures. He says in many cases, it's not that cities and towns want to raise taxes. It's just that taxes are a lagging indicator. They lag the ups and they lag the downs.
All things being equal, this would settle out eventually and things would return to equilibrium, as they say. But equilibrium really doesn't sell at the kitchen table.
In other words, even though taxes may dip next year based on this year's home values, people are mad. Some are calling for property tax caps. Clark County, Nevada, home of Las Vegas and all of its foreclosures, has a cap. It shielded homeowners from huge tax increases during the housing boom. But this year, despite the cap, most residents will still face a tax boost of up to 3%. Jeff Payson is Clark County's property appraisal manager.
Probably well into the 90% of our properties in Clark County have dropped, and some significantly, but until it reaches a certain level of an increase of 3% in tax dollars, they're not going to see a decline in their tax amount.
In fact, he says only about 20% will. The rest will pay higher property taxes to make up for years of skyrocketing home values. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There are two ways to look at the American automobile industry today. One is that some parts of it actually outperformed the stock market last year. Ford says its 2008 sales were down 21% January through December. That's less bad than the Dow and all the rest of them. On the other hand, for December, Chrysler sales were cut by more than half, so stocks are looking pretty good. No matter how you slice it, though, Detroit is likely to spend less on advertising in 2009, and that's going to cause its own problems, because car makers are traditionally the ad industry's biggest customers. But now they can't afford it, even as the need to boost sales is greater than ever, as Ashley Miltite reports.
During last year's Super Bowl, GM aired this ad for the Cadillac Escalade SUV.
Big. Bold, beautiful. Forget drive it. If it had a bathroom, I'd live in it.
This year, they're cutting back. For the first time in as long as a GM spokesman could remember, the company won't air any commercials during the game. Rebecca Lindland is an auto analyst with IHS Global Insight. She says GM and Chrysler need to keep a particularly close eye on their marketing budgets because they're being bailed out.
Every dollar that they spend, especially something as visible as advertising, is going to be scrutinized because suddenly this is taxpayers' money.
She says the drop in auto ads will be another blow for struggling newspapers and magazines, not to mention TV and radio.
This is not just a national issue. This is even down to the local level because a lot of local networks are supported by local dealerships.
And dealerships can barely afford to advertise these days. Peter DiLorenzo publishes AutoExtremist.com. He says it would be a mistake for carmakers to cut back too much.
I would advise these car companies to retain as much of their advertising and marketing presence as possible because they are going to need all of the image enhancement that they can get their hands on.
He says the major car makers have good fuel-efficient vehicles already and more coming out in 2009, and they have to get that message out to stay in business. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Wall Street meandered around all day today, never stuck its head above water. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Whatever the politics of a new stimulus package turn out to be, and they are going to be big, there are going to be a lot of questions, too. Tax cuts or more spending? Infrastructure or green jobs? Commentator Tyler Cowen says Congress ought to be asking whether there should be a stimulus package at all.
Borrowing and spending more money isn't the way out of a bad economy. Recovery is really about economic production. The phrase fiscal stimulus sounds like it will do good things, but in reality it's not so simple. First, a lot of project ideas won't put unemployed people to work. Take solar energy, which would be wonderful if it were cheaper. The whole point of solar energy is that the sun does most of the work. A new technology could be invented by scientists and designed by engineers, but those are exactly the people who already have jobs and are least likely to lose them. Obama also proposed broadband access for everyone, but again, that kind of construction doesn't match the skill set of the current unemployed. Second, quick projects are usually wasteful projects. Good new projects need to be thought out and planned. The environmental impact study alone can take years. But Obama told the state governments they'll have to use it or lose it when it comes to federal grants. The result will be a lot of poorly conceived projects just to capture the money. The biggest problem with the fiscal stimulus is this. Our economic problems stem from having spent too much in the first place. Now that our homes are no longer rising in value every year and America is aging, more saving is in order, not more spending. Recovery will come only when we discover which new and valuable things the economy should produce as it shifts out of real estate and finance. Simply borrowing and doling out more cash doesn't solve that problem. The federal government shouldn't just sit still. It's important to help state and local governments preserve their current budgeting, and that task will prove hard enough. We're all hoping for an economic revival, but the bitter reality is that we'll be very lucky simply to hold even and prevent further declines. Fiscal stimulus won't change that fact.
Tyler Cowen is a professor of economics at George Mason University. His blog is called Marginal Revolution. We've got a link to it on our website, which is marketplace.org. And while you're there, drop us a line. Click on that link that says contact. Modern-day slavery is a topic that's not easy to discuss, but it's too important and too big to avoid. By some estimates, slavery as an industry is worth about $91 billion a year. Sex slaves represent about 4% of all slaves around the world, but they account for about 40% of the profits. And as the global economy worsens, so could the lives of those women and children. Siddharth Kara's book about them and the business is called Sex Trafficking. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
As a purely business model question, slavery's all upside. I mean, it sounds flip, but really, it's almost hard to lose money doing it.
That is a very good point. The fundamental economics of slavery is to maximize profit by minimizing the cost of labor, in this case, zero or close to zero. So, yes, there is a tremendous profit incentive. There should be more risk to the commission of these crimes. Slavery is illegal in just about every country in the world, but there is almost no real risk to the exploitation of slaves around the world.
Why is that? I mean, if it's illegal, if governments know about it, which they all do because we're talking about it and everybody talks about it from time to time, why is this the case?
Weak laws. In India, for example, there's actually no financial penalty for exploiting a sex slave, but there is a $44 fine for owning a brothel. Now, you can actually make, as a brothel owner, close to $13,000 a year per slave in profit. So even if you rounded up every exploiter of sex slaves each and every year and fined them that $44, sex slavery would still be a high profit enterprise to be in.
As you think about how to eradicate sex slavery, and that's a good part of the book, you talk about the supply side and the demand side. But with access to sex slaves so cheap and human biology being what it is, can you ever really eradicate the demand side?
I do believe that the most effective attack on the sex slave industry in the near term is an attack on the demand force. To eradicate slavery in the long term, you'll have to address the supply side, issues relating to poverty, lawlessness, corruption, etc. But I, in the book, focus on what I call two strategic points of intervention in the fundamental business structure of sex slavery, and that's slave owner demand for profit and consumer demand for low-priced commercial sex. And if you can significantly increase the risk inherent to the system, increase the cost of committing these crimes, you can make a strong negative impact on both slave owner and consumer demand.
This is obviously an incredibly emotional topic. How do you remain so analytical about this? Because you clearly do.
It's not easy. As I sit here and talk with you about this business analysis, I have a business and legal background. My mind is still filled with the faces of so many of the slaves I met, hundreds of slaves who have suffered unspeakable acts of savagery, women and children who are raped, tortured, and killed every day. And I believe that a business and economic analysis is the best way to attack a fundamentally economic crime, slavery. But the moral outrage of these crimes and the human cost of these crimes is going to be what motivates us to initiate more effective efforts to redress these crimes.
Are you optimistic that anything's going to come of what you clearly hope to achieve with this book?
I go through waves of emotion. There are some real down days, and there were some down days on the research trail. For me, this book is step one. Step two is to get in front of the right audiences, governments, international organizations, and argue for the case I'm making for a new brand of global abolitionist movement that will design and deploy more effective tactics to abolish slavery once and for all.
The book by Siddharth Kara is called Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery. He sits on the board of directors of the group Free the Slaves. Siddharth, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up, paying less to eat better.
If you want a healthy entree and two sides, it's $3.99 versus a regular entree and two sides, which is $5.35.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave up 81 points today, 0.9% to close at 8,952. The NASDAQ fell 0.25%, 4 points to end at 1628. The S&P 500 also lost 4 points, 0.4%, finished at 927. President-elect Obama's stimulus plans couldn't overcome fears of weaker corporate profits, and that sent financial stocks down. J.P. Morgan Chase unloaded nearly 7%. Bank of America deducted almost 2.5%. Citigroup lost 0.8% today. Big telecom firms got the recession message. AT&T dialed down 3.25% on concerns that its wireless business would shrink. Verizon investors had the same hang-up. Its shares gave back 6.25% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.47%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the 111th Congress is sworn in. The Commerce Department reports on factory orders for November. And the holidays continue in some regions with the Christian celebration Epiphany, marking the day the three wise men visited the infant Jesus. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Even given all we've been through courtesy of Wall Street the past 18 months, the case of Bernie Madoff continues to be the icing on the cake. Madoff was arrested 3 weeks ago amid charges he'd been running a $50 billion Ponzi scheme. He was in court today in New York. Prosecutors were trying to get his bail revoked, saying he's a flight risk. The judge put off a decision on that matter, but down in Washington, Mr. Madoff was present in spirit. The House Financial Services Committee is trying to figure out how the Securities and Exchange Commission missed this guy. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
The SEC received complaints about Madoff for more than a decade. One whistleblower told the SEC repeatedly that the steady gains Madoff was reporting to investors were mathematically impossible. The SEC did investigate, but never accused Madoff of wrongdoing.
Our regulatory system has failed miserably, and we must rebuild it now.
That's Congressman Paul Kanjorski, a Pennsylvania Democrat. The agency's critics say SEC officials don't aggressively investigate Wall Street because they're hoping to get lucrative jobs at the very firms they oversee. Donald Langford disagrees. He's a former SEC lawyer, now at Georgetown University. Langford says the problem is the SEC doesn't want to hurt investor confidence, even if it's false confidence.
When you see a bubble, when employment or the stock market is increasing, the message is don't mess with that.
Another problem is Madoff wasn't required to register his hedge fund with the SEC. The thinking is only rich people can afford to invest in hedge funds, so they must be savvy enough to protect themselves. Wrong. Jim Kaufman is a retired SEC investigator.
Should we be looking at hedge funds that control trillions of dollars and are virtually unregulated? That's something that Congress is going to have to take another look at, I think, after this.
For now, the SEC's inspector general says he'll examine its enforcement operations and inspection divisions and make recommendations. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
All this scheming and double dealing in the news doesn't speak too highly of the world of personal finance. It got us wondering about whether endlessly hearing about the likes of Bernie Madoff might affect everyone else's sense of right and wrong, too. Luckily enough for us, behavioral economist Dan Ariely has been doing some research on just that topic.
We got a group of students and we gave them a set of very simple math questions. And some people tried to solve them. And when they finished, we paid them 50 cents per correct question. Some people, we prepaid them. They had all the money in the envelope. And we said, when you finish, give us back the money you didn't make. And unsurprisingly, perhaps, many people cheated by a few questions. The most interesting thing is that we had a student that we hired, an acting student at Carnegie Mellon, who stood up after a few seconds and said, I solved everything. Clearly cheating, because nobody can solve all these questions in 30 seconds. What should I do? And the experimenter said, if you finished, go home. Now, what will this create? Will people cheat more or cheat less? Well, it turns out it depended on what kind of sweatshirt he was wearing.
I'm sorry, what kind of sweatshirt?
Yes, what kind of sweatshirt?
Okay.
Here's the story. We ran this at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. And in Pittsburgh, there are two universities, Carnegie Mellon, University of Pittsburgh. All the students who participated were Carnegie Mellon students. If the cheating student, the acting student, was wearing a Carnegie Mellon sweatshirt, he basically got people to cheat more. But if he was wearing the University of Pittsburgh sweatshirt, he got people to cheat less. What is basically happening here is that when he stood there with a Carnegie Mellon sweatshirt, he gave a social justification for a new social norm to emerge about cheating. But when he was wearing the University of Pittsburgh sweatshirt, all of a sudden, people said, this is cheating. This is what the other people in the bad school are doing. This is not what we're doing. And therefore, cheated actually less.
Take this back into real life for me, though, and let's pull an example from the headlines. Bernie Madoff, the guy who allegedly ran the Ponzi scheme, does something like that. Highly publicized, a guy on Wall Street, been around for a long time. Does that then, do you think, inspire people to cheat more or less?
So I think it depends on how we frame it. If we are framing it as he's a part of Wall Street, it will be like the guy wearing the Carnegie Mellon sweatshirt. It will be a part of the in-group and would increase what is acceptable in the banker's eyes in terms of cheating. But if they were able to frame him as a University of Pittsburgh student, as an outsider, somebody who's from a different investment firm with a different approach, not typical of Wall Street, then they might actually decrease cheating with that approach.
Is there a way to use other factors to try to stop this cheating? And I'm just thinking about, you know, making people aware of their ethical obligations. I mean, everybody who works on Wall Street has a trading license and they know they're not supposed to do these things. What if you remind them of that at the beginning of every business day?
Yeah. So we actually find very good evidence for this. We've done it multiple times. So sometimes we ask people to try and recall the Ten Commandments. And after trying to recall the Ten Commandments, we give them a chance to cheat and steal money, and nobody does. And it's not as if the people who remembered more commandments cheat less, and the people
right.
who remembered few commandments cheat more. It's nobody cheats after that. The moment we remind people about their honor of themselves, their own standards, they stop cheating.
Dan Ariely teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. His book on the topic at hand is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Well, here we are, day five. How are the resolutions going? Are you spending less money, being more productive, eating better? Losing weight and improving health are perennials at New Year's. This year, a lot of companies have them on their lists, too, and they're putting their money where your mouth is. Shia Levitt reports.
And vegetable?
Green.
Okay. Thank you. Have a great day.
At the Florida Power & Light Company cafeteria, signs list the nutritional sins and virtues of every menu item. The idea is to help employees make healthy choices. But if calorie and fat counts aren't enough to steer diners away from cheeseburgers and fries, there are some other numbers that might.
If you want a healthy entree and two sides, it's $3.99 versus a regular entree and two sides, which is $5.35.
That's Andy Schiavelli, Florida Power & Light's Manager of Employee Health and Well-Being. He says the company subsidizes about 20% of the cost of each healthy meal. Diners also get a punch card to earn a free meal for every dozen healthy ones they buy. Those who skip salad and grilled fish pick up part of the tab.
So in essence, the individuals that are eating regular or food that isn't as healthy are actually helping to subsidize the cost of the healthier meals.
Have a good day. Thank you. Thank you.
As healthcare costs rise, several large companies are trying similar strategies. Employers hope they will boost productivity, lower medical costs, and reduce turnover. Freddie Mac has a punch card program. Florida Power and Light spends about $150 annually per employee on a wide-ranging wellness program. Schiavelli says the numbers of people buying healthy foods in the cafeteria have been steadily improving since the incentive started. But not everyone feels the same about the taste. Employee Gina Guarino says she still prefers the quesadillas.
To me, I think some of the healthy choices are a little bland, so that's why I tend to go for something else with a little more flavor. I think I do other things to promote my health as far as exercising, things like that.
For state employees in Alabama, financial incentives go beyond a cheaper lunch. Those with obesity, hypertension, or high cholesterol now have a year to address their problem or pay $25 extra each month for health insurance. New York University economist Lawrence White says there's a fine line between incentives and punishing employees who won't change their behavior. People like options, he says, and that includes the choice to buy those fries.
As soon as employees feel like there's a cop on the beat, that someone is looking over their shoulder, there's feels like a line of intrusiveness that the employer has stepped over, and boy, that can really destroy employee morale.
But if rewarding employees for giving up Cheetos from 9 to 5 makes them happier and healthier, White says that could boost productivity. Of course, that doesn't take into account what they're eating once they leave the office. I'm Shia Levitt for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, shares of Apple jumped almost 4.25% today on news that CEO Steve Jobs isn't dying. Insensitive of me, perhaps, but rumors had been rampant that Jobs' health isn't so great, especially after he canceled his appearance at this week's Macworld convention. Shares had dropped 10% in the 2 weeks since. Jobs now says it's nothing more than a hormonal imbalance. He is a survivor of pancreatic cancer, by the way. Both Jobs and the company have been criticized for not being more forthcoming about the health of the guy who has basically become Apple. And whether you're a Mac guy or a Windows guy, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 81 points, 0.9%. The Nasdaq fell 4 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 lost 4 points, 0.4% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, a new driver in transportation costs.
The last time I checked, it did not pay to make gasoline, but it paid to make asphalt. The difference was over $13 a barrel.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.